This is Carol Bond, returning with the December 8th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. We're going to begin this part of our program with a reading of the obituaries. Versi L. Barbie, 92, of Decatur, departed this life on Wednesday, December 2nd, at Symphony of Decatur. Homegoing services will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, December 10th, 2015, at Antioch Missionary Baptist Church, with visitation 1 hour before service. Professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Service. Alexandria Elizabeth Clark, 27, Mansfield, died Saturday, December 5th, 2015. Services 2 p.m. Thursday, Mansfield United Methodist Church. Visitation 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, Calvert Benlange Bruce Funeral Home, Farmer City. Burial, Mansfield Cemetery. Memorials, GoFundMe account at Help for Alex, for her children. Barbara Hardy, 92, of Decatur, passed away on Saturday, December 5th, in St. Mary's Hospital. Barbara the family of Barbara is being served by Moran and Gerbel Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 2801 North Monroe Street, Decatur. Graveside service to celebrate Barbara's life will be 10 a.m. Friday, December 11th, in Greenwood Cemetery. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday in Moran and Gerbel Funeral Home. Jeffrey R. Long, 44, of Decatur, passed away at 5 p.m. Friday, December 4th, in Barnes Jewish Hospital, St. Louis, Missouri. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, December 9th, at First Christian Church, Decatur. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, December 8th, that's today, at Brinlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Burial will be in North Fork Cemetery, Decatur. Memorials may be made to First Christian Church. Roy Keith Montgomery, 73, of Decatur, passed away December 6th at Decatur Memorial Hospital, surrounded by his family. There will be no visitation or funeral. Donald H. Skip Shull, 65, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, December 5th, and in his home. Services to celebrate Skip's life will be 2 p.m. Wednesday, December 9th, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to services at the funeral home. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Memorials in memory of Skip may be made to Homeward Bound Pet Shelter. Richard Leroy Dick Storm, age 83, of Arthur, passed away at 9:50 p.m. on Saturday, December 5th, at the Arthur home. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, December 8th, at the Arthur Mennonite Church, 710 East Park Street in Arthur. Masonic rites will be observed prior to visitation. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, December 9th, at Arthur Mennonite Church, Pastor Glenn Rhodes officiating. Burial with military rites conducted by the Arthur American Legion Post 479 will be in the Arthur Cemetery. Memorial gifts may be made to the Arthur Home or the Arthur Mennonite Church. We return now to the local news, and this headline is labeled an editor's pick. It was written by Tony Reed. Neighbor saves man from burning home. Firefighters are praising a Decatur man who braved a burning house Monday evening to save his neighbor. Larry Heath entered the house at 2358 East William Street to drag clear his male neighbor, who had been overcome with smoke and fumes while trying to save his pet dog from the fire. The injured neighbor was doing well, but had been taken to hospital for an evaluation, according to Battalion Chief Dan Klein. We want to credit Mr. Heath for saving the male occupant of this home, Klein said. Our guys also did a very good job, and we found the dog quickly and attempted to revive it using resuscitation equipment we have specifically for animals, but sadly, we were unsuccessful. The alarm had been raised about 5:15 p.m., and the male and female couple who lived in the home and their 5-year-old granddaughter, who they were babysitting, had all got clear as the flames took hold in the living room. But Klein said the man went back inside to try and save the small terrier-type dog and was overcome with smoke in the story-and-a-half home's kitchen area where Heath found him. The fire had spread rapidly and had burned through the ceiling into the dormer attic space before it was put out. The cause is under investigation. The house is not livable, and the American Red Cross was assisting the couple with temporary accommodation. Let's turn now to see what some of our columnists are saying. Dear Abby has this letter to begin. A good friend of mine recently found out his daughter, Rhonda, who is over 18, feels she should have been born a boy. Ronnie is now living life as a man and plans to change genders completely. To say the least, my friend and his wife are finding it difficult to deal with. He doesn't understand why she can't just be gay, which he would be fine with. I want to give them emotional support while at the same time supporting Ronnie, but I'm having a hard time relating to their feelings. Could you provide some resources for them, such as organizations that help families deal with gender changing and all that it entails? And the letter is signed, Wants to be Supportive. Dear Wants to be Supportive, I know an excellent LGBT organization that has been mentioned before in my column. It's called Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, or PFLAG. The largest increase in new individuals reaching out to PFLAG is now among trans people and their family members. Ronnie can't just be gay, because the issue isn't sexual orientation. It is Ronnie's gender identity. PFLAG can help to explain this to Ronnie's father, and he should visit PFLAG.org for guidance. The next letter is written as follows. Dear Abby, I have been with John for 18 years. We married while he was in prison. I know I have outgrown him, but I'm scared to say it's over in case I realize later that we should be together. Over the years, we have both cheated and hurt each other. I don't know exactly what I am holding on to with him. There doesn't seem to be anyone else out there to choose from, so maybe I should just say I'm not afraid to be alone, but I am confused. Maybe I should stay. I am suffering from depression over this. Please help. Signed, Stuck in Des Moines. Dear Stuck, if the only reason you haven't left John is that there's no one else around to choose from, it's understandable that you would be depressed. The status quo isn't fair for you or your husband. As I see it, you have two choices: fix your marriage or leave. Of course, the better option would be for you and John to have counseling to see if your love can be revived. However, if it doesn't work, then it might be better for you both to separate. The reason there is no one else out there right now may be that you are unavailable. The next. Dear Abby, call me ungrateful, but I am very uncomfortable receiving gifts. How can I get longtime friends to stop bringing hostess gifts when I invite them over? I don't need anything, and I resent feeling I am obligated to take something to them, too. Why do women do this and men not feel so compelled? I have tried remarking, the present of your presence is present enough, but it continues. I need your help. Signed, Ungracious in Florida. Dear Ungracious, women usually bring hostess gifts because they were raised to believe it is the gracious thing to do. Don't come empty-handed. Since remarking hasn't gotten your message across, you will have to be more direct with your friends. Tell them that when they visit, you would prefer they bring only themselves and nothing more. Then explain that you are at a point where you have enough things and do not need or want any more. We'll turn now to the editorials page. This is the official editorial written under the headline, Our Views. No Child Left Behind Exits Quietly. The era of federal pressure to improve schools, brought on by the No Child Left Behind legislation, is ending quietly. A bill that replaces the landmark education bill sailed easily through the House last week. The Senate is expected to approve the bill, and President Barack Obama has said he will sign it. The new legislation called the Every Student Succeeds Act, requires annual standardized tests, and the results will be broken out among students by race, income, and special needs. But there will no longer be federal pressure to meet certain standards. The states and local officials will set academic goals and decide if students are making acceptable progress. Many will celebrate the end of No Child Left Behind for some good reasons. The law required adequate yearly progress goals that increased each year. The No Child Left Behind legislation was never fair to districts or schools with challenging student populations, especially districts with a large number of poor students. Those districts complained for years that the system was unfair, but backlash against the legislation only grew when those schools and districts that considered themselves well off started falling behind the adequate yearly progress standards. While the No Child Left Behind has been much maligned, it did force school districts to come to grips with some objective standards. Standardized testing cannot be the only measure of whether students are learning, but it has to be a part of the measuring stick. Many have forgotten the impetus behind No Child Left Behind was the feeling that students weren't learning. The Every Student Succeeds Act does require states to create plans to work with schools in the bottom 5% statewide or in schools that graduate less than two-thirds of students. The states, however, would set the goals and deadline for progress. The law also abandons efforts to encourage the evaluation of teachers based in part on student academic growth. Hopefully, that won't lead to efforts to undo the teacher evaluation system in Illinois. Supporters of Every Student Succeeds argue that setting standards and helping students or helping schools succeed are issues that are better handled at the state and local level. In theory, we agree. However, history has taught us that states and local school districts are not always adept at enforcing standards. There is a tendency in the education bureaucracy to claim everything is fine when it isn't. There is no doubt that No Child Left Behind has outlived its usefulness and become ineffective. Every Student Succeeds relaxes much of the federal pressure put on states and school districts. States and school districts would be wise to use that reprieve to redouble local efforts to make sure that all students receive a valuable education. Here's another article that the editorial board has selected for the columnist page. It's written by Leonard Pitts Jr., and the headline is, "Like Rocky, Keep Fighting Against Time." In the new movie, Creed, Rocky Balboa once again mounts the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. In the original Rocky, the climb up those stairs was the climax of a training montage that has since become iconic. With the gladiatorial horns and sweeping strings of Bill Conti's soundtrack pumping full out behind him, Rocky takes those stairs at a celebratory run, dancing and shadowboxing when he reaches the top. But that was 39 years ago. In Creed, Rocky walks. He needs help. He has to take a breather. It is a soulful juxtaposition to his run up those same stairs when he was young. A moment of almost unbearable tenderness that reminds you just how long and how short is 39 years. I occasionally find myself wishing I could see Rocky again for the first time. I wish I could experience again that first surge of wow and can do that came when Rocky Balboa, this unheralded club fighter nobody ever heard of, tagged preening champion Apollo Creed with an up-from-nowhere left that dropped him like an ex-boyfriend. It is axiomatic that there are moments when art imitates life, but there are also moments, rare though they are, when art impinges life, when it affects you and you find yourself different after the experience than you were before. Rocky was one of those moments for me. It was a battle cry for underdogs, losers, and misfits, a Bronx cheer to conventional wisdom and long odds. It was a reminder that the secret of success is ultimately pretty simple. Get knocked down, but keep getting up. Creed, the movie, is all those things too, but it is also subtly something more, a reminder to, quote, rage against the dying of the light. You sometimes hear athletes and TV commentators speak of how Father Time is undefeated, and he is. You need only look at 37-year-old Kobe Bryant struggling through his final season of professional basketball to know how true that is. You need only note how abruptly mediocrity landed on Bryant, the fieriest combination of will and skill this side of Michael Jordan, to understand that time is a thief. Life and Creed are about how you respond as time does those things. When Rocky was released, writer and star Sylvester Stallone was 30 years old. Almost 40 years later, Creed finds Stallone's signature character aged, ailing, and alone. Adrian, the wife who loved him, Mickey, the manager who trained him, Apollo, the opponent who befriended him, Polly, the brother-in-law who exasperated him, all are gone. And on some level, Rocky is simply marking time until he joins them. Enter Adonis Johnson, the out-of-wedlock son of his old opponent. Unheralded like Rocky was, underdog like Rocky was, fighting for respect as Rocky did, he cajoles the old pug into training him. In the process, he also cajoles him back into life. It's not simply that Rocky finds a surrogate son or even renewed purpose in readying Adonis for the ring. Rather, it's that he rediscovers the thing that made him him. So much of what time steals, we have no choice about. Your legs are going to go. Your loved ones are going to go, whether you acquiesce to it or not. But to watch Rocky struggle up those steps he once conquered by leaps and bounds is to know that the thing inside that makes you get up from every knockdown is different. Its loss is not predetermined by age. Rather, it's a choice. You decide to let time take that thing away from you or not. An editor's pick is this. Response to shootings is often misguided. Mass shootings elicit a chorus much like the widespread response to the Islamic State. We must do something now, and any measure is better than none. In the wake of the San Bernardino massacre, there's no shortage of tough-sounding solutions on offer, but they are largely exercises in well-meaning futility. Anything is not always better than nothing. The automatic prescription anytime someone uses firearms to slaughter a group of people is stricter control on guns and gun owners. But the San Bernardino episode illustrates the puny impact of such measures. California, after all, has among the tightest restrictions in the country. They didn't stop Saeed Farouk and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, from killing 14 people and injuring 21 in a barrage of some 150 bullets. The state has long prohibited assault weapons. Anyone who owned one before the ban was required to register it. Magazines holding more than 10 rounds are also illegal. Federal law allows private sales without background checks, and the state mandates a 10-day waiting period for every gun purchase. So California is pretty much a gun controller's dream. Yet an editorial in the LA Times immediately demanded universal background checks and a ban on military style weapons in large magazines, the author having forgotten perhaps that those are already in place. If those proposals were not sufficiently irrelevant, the editorial also urged more trigger locks and the abolition of concealed carry laws, neither of which would have made any positive difference in San Bernardino. On Thursday, the Senate blocked legislation introduced by California's Dianne Feinstein to stipulate that people on the Transportation Security Administration's no-fly list may not buy guns. Obama endorsed the idea, but evidently neither of the killers was on the no-fly list. Farouk flew to Saudi Arabia earlier this year, and Malik flew back with him after passing a background check for her visa. It's hard to think of any plausible safeguard that would have blocked firearm acquisitions by the husband, a Chicago-born U.S. citizen with a government job, a spotless record, and no known history of mental illness. German criminals can easily evade the law. Two people capable of making or acquiring more than a dozen pipe bombs, which are not sold at Walmart, probably have ways of getting the sort of guns they deem necessary. Trying to prevent carnage by getting rid of assault weapons is like trying to prevent alcoholism by outlawing vodka. There are plenty of good substitutes. Limiting the size of magazines is also no hurdle for a minimally competent shooter who can bring extras to quickly replace depleted ones. To note these realities is not to succumb to despair. The good news is that it is possible to drastically reduce gun violence. In fact, we have already done it. The rate of fatal shootings has dropped by almost half in the past 2 decades, and the rate of non-fatal shootings has plunged by 75%. The crucial change has come not by law, but in our culture. Americans are less violent today than in the past, for reasons we don't entirely understand. What about mass shootings? The prevailing belief is that they are becoming far more common, but Northeastern University criminologist James Allen Fox has noted that regardless of whether you look at the past 5 years or the past 30, there has been no upward trend. What has increased hugely is the amount of media attention such incidents get. Increasing or not, it would be nice if someone could devise a reliable way to prevent these gruesome atrocities. Until then, let's not fool ourselves. The columnist is Steve Chapman, who blogs daily at the Chicago Tribune. This has been Carol Bond with the Decatur Herald and Review, December 8th issue. I look forward very much to reading with you again.